Let me formally introduce myself. I'm Kimberly Mobley. I'm the Director of Communications and Member Services for NACEP. I'm very excited today to be having these presenters come because they were some of our most highly rated presenters from the conference. Before I formally introduce them, though, I'm going to pass the mic along to our president, Sandy Gonzalez, and let her say a few words. Sandy.
Thanks very much. Well, I just want to extend a warm welcome to all of you for joining the webinar today. I'm very excited that you can be here, and I think it's also exciting that NACEP can offer webinars like these. And, of course, a big reason is because we do have Kim on board now as our Director of Communications and Membership Services, and it's great to have her and be able to offer these extra services to our members. You know, people tell us that when you go to a NACEP conference, people tell us that one of the frustrations is not getting to all the presentations you want to see. And I know that's been especially true for me the last few years. So it's also, of course, really hard for those who can't make it to the conference. So, you know, I'm very glad we can get this opportunity going and get the highlights from the best presentations. Today's topic of skepticism in the world of concurrent enrollment, it's shocking that anybody's on here because I know none of us have ever run across anybody who's, you know, critical of concurrent enrollment. But here we are, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what we can learn, and I'm sure you also are. So welcome again, and I hope you enjoy it. And I'll turn it back to Kim.
Okay, thank you so much. So I'm just going to briefly introduce our presenters, and then we're going to have we're going to have them present back-to-back, and then following that, we're going to do Q&A on the webinar. So if you have any questions, feel free to put them in the messenger box as we go, and then there's also kind of a Q&A tab that we'll use following the presentations to do that. We'll try to wrap it up within the hour, and maybe beforehand, because I know everybody's kind of in that Christmas mood and anxious to get out and get things wrapped up before vacation. So. First, let me introduce Dr. Wintermeyer. She's the Director of Dual Enrollment Programs at Santa Barbara City College and oversees more than 100 concurrent course offerings on local high school campuses, as well as the enrollment of approximately 2,500 to 3,000 students per year. She's conducted research on dual enrollment for her dissertation and continues to work with researchers from the University of California, Santa Barbara, to conduct longitudinal evaluations of Santa Barbara City College's programs. Very excited to have you, Lauren.
Thank you so much.
Following Lauren's presentation, we will be hearing from Dr. Laura Lee Stevens. Dr. Stevens is Assistant Dean of Community Outreach at Johnson County Community College. She has worked with concurrent enrollment partnerships for over a decade and in higher education for over 20 years. She manages the largest and only accredited concurrent enrollment partnership program in Kansas. So welcome, Laura Lee.
Thank you very much.
So let's go ahead and get started with Lauren. The floor is yours.
Thanks so much, Kim. I am not seeing the presentation right now, so.
I'm going to put it on your
screen. Okay, great. Thank you so much.
When you want me to go to the next slide.
Okay, thank you. And it's a pleasure to be here with all of you. Happy holidays. I'm really excited to talk about our program. We had a great turnout at NACEP, and I think we had really rich dialogue about the challenges many of us face in our local partnerships. So, Kim, I'm still not seeing it. Is it on its way? Or should I be seeing the PowerPoint now?
No, you should be seeing it. Sandy, are you seeing it?
I'm seeing it.
All right.
Warren, are you seeing any PowerPoint slides?
I'm not. I'm seeing the screen on which people can. Oh, I got it now. Okay, we're good. Sorry about that.
Nope.
Okay. So as Kim said, you know, I work in Santa Barbara, and we are the largest dual enrollment program that we know of in our state, and we have a system of 112 community colleges. So we really do try to get out there and share what we're doing as a best practice. And Kim, if you want to go ahead to the next slide. Last summer when Adam sent out the article about the dark side of dual enrollment, I was sort of mystified as to the perspective of the author, because it seemed that it took the experience of one student and put that out there as, you know, large consumption for everybody and a real generalized statement of what dual enrollment looks like in different areas, and we would like to counter that. So that's what we're trying to do here. And I guess I can forward my own slides. That's great. So we, as a group here at our college, we really tried to look at myth busting and what are the myths around dual enrollment. We wanted to look at the different policies that exist nationwide, as well as some of the data that is out there, and then bring it back and look at our local data. We shared with our attendees in the conference about managing the program image effectively and what that looks like when you're sharing details about your program with faculty and administration as well as classified staff on your campus. And then we did some strategic planning that I invite you to do as you bring this back to your teams as well. So because of the sake of time, I'm going to tell you what we saw as the dark side of dual enrollment. And I think it's important for any program to grow by first looking at, you know, their strengths, weaknesses, and opportunities for growth. So we looked at the challenge around getting quality faculty and how NACEP and the accreditation process can really help with that. But that we struggle with finding folks who really want to work in both worlds. They want to be engaged on the college side and at the high school. And I feel we have a great local group of educators, but I think many of the skeptics around dual enrollment feel that if someone's teaching at the high school level, perhaps they aren't qualified to teach at the college, and I would argue wholeheartedly that we don't see it quite that way. And we also looked at the challenge around college rigor and ensuring that that is checked on at both site levels, looking at the alignment and accuracy of the course and making sure nothing's watered down on the high school site. Definitely we hear skeptics saying that the way classes are offered out on high school sites through concurrent enrollment do not match what they see at the college, so we wanted to acknowledge that concern. We have experienced some pushback in our own college from different academic departments that there's sort of a different philosophy on how they view what they are charged to do as professors. And I may frustrate people by using that term, but educational elitism is something that I think really doesn't belong in education, and yet it's a barrier to what we are able to do when people see that, you know, being a professor at a college is somehow superior to being a K-12 educator. And unfortunately, I think that there are folks who are in one camp or the other. We also know that there's concern about pushing students too far and too fast. So you think about AP students and movies like The Race to Nowhere, and that highlight on students being very stressed, living a life that's out of balance as they're eager to continue to advance their scholastic studies at sort of the sacrifice of all health and balance in their life. We certainly have heard concerns about educators thinking that students are placed into concurrent or dual enrollment courses and that they're underprepared for those courses. And then another concern we've heard is, and we share, is about helicopter parents maybe enrolling their students in courses, having far too much involvement in their students' scholastic work in a college-level course, and I would say even at the high school level as well. So when we started to look at the counter-arguments to the dark side, and please feel free to think about any of the other criticisms you've heard, that was just a sampling, we really wanted to counter those arguments with what we know to be true for our own program and why we think having the standards of accreditation are incredibly important. We hold our faculty at the high school sites who are teaching for our college departments to the same minimum qualifications that are set by the Chancellor's Office for our entire community college system statewide. We also have our adjunct evaluations are conducted in the same way out at the high school sites as they would be here on the college campus. So for our site, that means all instructors are evaluated their first, second, and fourth semesters of teaching and triannually after that. And again, that's the same for an adjunct faculty regardless of where they're teaching site-wise. The college rigor, we have articulation meetings every semester for all of our areas, all of our disciplines. For some of our more intense course offerings where we have a larger number of sections, we actually meet every semester, but most of them are annual meetings. And within those meetings, we look at all of the expectations around the course syllabus, the approved textbook, the student learning outcomes, all of the admissions and records procedures. We discuss the evaluation process and really make sure everyone's on the same page. Within our program model, our high schools request courses based on having a faculty member whom they think is qualified to teach for the college, but we allow our college department chairs to put their stamp of approval on that instructor and to allow a course to take place. For the course alignment, again, you know, we're looking at everything being aligned. So whether a student is enrolled in the course here on our main campus or out at a high school site, the course content, the rigor, and everything will be aligned. Of course, the prerequisites are the same. If there's any assessments required, our high school students take the exact same assessment. Within the pushback that I mentioned from some of our academic departments, we're really working on fostering collaborative relationships to look at the what's in it for me attitude. We look at our concurrent enrollment partnerships as an opportunity for students to have access to our college early and to get into pipelines that they can then continue if they choose to matriculate here as a full-time student after high school. So this is an ongoing effort to collaborate and maintain relationships as we have a change in department chairs every couple of years. We have new faculty members and, of course, new site leads and teachers at our high school sites as well. I share that concern about students being pushed too far, too fast. And, you know, we really want to make sure that students are appropriately brought into the fold and taught about our dual enrollment program. So I got kicked out of the system. Please bear with me for a moment. I'm not sure how that happened. And Kim, if you're there, I don't know if I'm doing something wrong, but.
You know? I have no idea.
Okay. All right. Here. I'm back in it. Sorry about that, everyone. You never know with technology.
Yeah, we might get into a new webinar system for the next one.
Okay. And now it looks like I can't forward my slides, so Kim, you'll be in charge after this. So, again, we're looking at student eligibility, making sure they have appropriate advising, and within our state law, we are required to get the signature of a high school counselor or administrator to allow a student to participate in the program. So we're looking to our high schools to be the appropriate gatekeeper and ensure that students are being placed appropriately. However, within our state and in our local board implementation of state policy, we want our dual enrollment program to be accessible. Our program is open to students in grades 9 through 12, and we have about a 50-50 course offering between CTE and academic courses to try to create a pathway option for all students regardless of their academic level at that point. Of course, we expect them to be able to complete their coursework at the college level in order to earn college credit. And then with helicopter parents, we're very clear in explaining the FERPA regulations and what we can and cannot share with them. But that is an ongoing challenge because many parents want to really shelter the experience for their students, understandably, but we gently encourage them to allow their students to take an advocacy role in their own education. So I think it's a learning opportunity for students and their parents on navigating post-secondary pathways. So, Kim, if you can advance for me, that would be great. So we looked at concurrent policies nationwide. I'm not going to spend a lot of time because I imagine people have looked through these, but there's a lot of variation across state and even local implementation of state policy. So whether you have age restrictions in your area, GPA requirements, et cetera, I know that can have a strong influence on your program model. I know the state apportionment models vary greatly. Within our state, we are allowed to collect apportionment at the college after the high schools collect their ADA, their average daily attendance, on 240 minutes of attendance. So making sure everybody's aware of how the funding model works, I think, is incredibly important when you're looking at myth busting. We've heard, that faculty unions have questioned that perhaps a concurrent enrollment program might rob a college of money when actually, when we looked at the numbers, our program brings about $1 million into our institution annually. So that's a pretty good counter argument. Some states charge students. Our local board decided not to charge high school students who are California residents. And then, of course, looking at the course quality, many states really do look closely at that. So knowing the ins and outs of your own state policy and implementation of that policy, I think, will help you when providing counter arguments. And then looking at how credit is earned by the students is also a really interesting discussion to have, because in some states, students have to make sure that the credit is counted in both areas. Other states differ. For us, if a course has a prerequisite, a student must be enrolled with the college and earn credit on both sides. But in some cases, such as, an art course or multimedia course, the student is allowed to participate without being concurrently enrolled with the college. So you really want to know the ins and outs of your program and what your partner schools are working on. And we'll go to the next one. some of the things that I would encourage you to consider are barriers to your program development. If you're looking at concurrent enrollment for the first time, what are the hurdles you face? And or if you're expanding, are you facing a challenge on qualified teachers? One of the things we see are many K-12 teachers with master's degrees in education, and that does not meet our minimum qualifications to be an adjunct faculty member. They need a discipline-specific master's degree for most of our degree, most of our course offerings. So we've looked at that. What are the professional development needs of our teachers? We've also looked at some of the barriers being union law and concern from the union that somehow creating a concurrent enrollment partnership would displace full-time employed teachers. So those are discussions to have across both unions, at both the college side and the high school side. Looking at things that are going to improve your quality, I think are really important on that myth-busting side. What can you do strategically? To adhere to the national standards of accreditation. And then what types of policy change can you look at that are going to increase equity and access? Because I think a large criticism we hear nationwide is that concurrent enrollment partnerships and opportunities are for very high academically advanced students who are going straight to four-year schools, et cetera. And our mission is really access and equity across the board. So that's part of what has helped us expand our dual enrollment programs to house our Get Focused, Stay Focused initiative as well. If you're interested, I can share information about that. And Kim will keep going. So for concurrent enrollment data, CCRC, for out of Columbia College, or the Teachers College from Columbia University, their Community College Research Center has fantastic reports. If you have not seen them, I strongly encourage you to look through. Even if you just look at the data briefs, you're bound to find some solid data that can back you up if you are an advocate for concurrent enrollment. Their studies are things that we found here at our own site, that students are more likely to graduate and persist if they've participated. They need less remediation in math and English, and they earn more college credits. The 2020 Vision article, there's a link there, and I think all of this will be available later, but there's some great model components that are recommended for concurrent enrollment programs if you're looking at developing one. And that actually came from our Community College League in the state of California. Next slide, please. Kim, are you there? Thanks so much. So I looked at our institutional data back in 2008 for my own dissertation, and this was prior to me working here in the college in dual enrollment, but I looked at the student matriculation rates and just used secondary data to find out if our dual enrollment program as it existed at that time had any influence on student persistence when they matriculated to community college. So I did not look at students who went straight to a four-year school who had taken concurrent enrollment. I just looked at those who came to Santa Barbara City College right after graduation. And what I found was that students were more likely to enroll full-time and all the other criteria I mentioned previously. And after 3 years, so six academic semesters, found that they had a higher average GPA and had earned more transferable units, which would allow them more access to transferring to one of our four-year colleges within the state or out of state. And we'll keep moving on. And within our own data, I think it's also important to note that students who participated in concurrent enrollment at both their high school site and here on our main college campus had the highest outcomes. But we still see, you know, a lack of students coming in prepared for what we call the transfer level of English and math. So that's something we're working on. As part of our Get Focused, Stay Focused initiative, which is a whole other presentation in and of itself, we started looking at what we've created as a dual enrollment freshman transition course and possible outcomes linked to that course offering. Now, A through G are our course requirements for students to be able to apply to a four-year state school within California. So it's basically the college preparatory sequence of courses. And the year that we started our freshman transition course, our dual enrollment freshman transition, was 2009. So if you look at this small graph here, the 2009 year, the high school graduating class at Carpinteria High School had a 24.2% completion rate of the college prep sequence to be eligible to apply to a four-year school. And this past year, our very first cohort who took the freshman course graduated and 47.6 had completed that same college prep sequence of courses. So I can't say that it's all because of the dual enrollment freshman transition course. Of course, there's many other factors we need to look at. But in general, when we start to use data to help support our program, people respond because what we're showing is an increase in college preparatory experience for our students. And we know that a key component was our dual enrollment program. So we'll go to the next slide. We also were able to show an increase in the academic performance index for that high school. And once again, we know there are other programs happening at the school and other interventions, but we have seen an increase in student participation and concurrent enrollment. So we know that we are a piece of this puzzle if we dig down deeper. And we'll keep going. We also saw a decrease in suspensions at that high school. Again, this is really something we're linking to our freshman transition course, but what that freshman course does is open the door for every single student in our local service area high schools to take a dual enrollment class when they start high school. We shelter it in a very safe way. It's a pass-no-pass course. It's an elective credit, and we don't require students to enroll with the college, but they do receive the outreach information to the college and try to set the mindset for the students that all of them are college material. We'll keep going. Next slide, please. I think I got kicked out again. I apologize. Sorry for the delay. So within our program, what we've been looking at with Get Focused, Stay Focused is a chance for students in early in high school to access dual enrollment so that even if they choose not to enroll for credit in the freshman course, as they move through high school, they will be better able to navigate that pathway. So, for example, a student in 11th grade may decide they're ready for dual enrollment, and now it won't be the first time they've seen the paperwork from our college. So I can now see my next slide. Thanks so much. Managing your program image, I think, is very important because you're managing an image with your K-12 system as well as within the college. And what we realize is, within a community college, and we have over 20,000 students here, we struggle just within our institution to make sure that everyone's communicating and on the same page about our efforts with dual enrollment. But then beyond that, we need to contribute to that conversation out in the community. And we also see that there are a lot of misperceptions, as I mentioned previously, within our faculty body. So those are our internal factors, but then we also look at how we message outside. So if you're countering any naysayers out there, what you may want to look at is putting data on your website, looking at social networking tools, just increasing, maybe even holding a community symposium to share information about your program and answer those questions publicly that people may have. I think it's very easy for the rumor mill to churn, and one of the things I credit our college president with doing is holding regular myth-busting sessions. So whether we're having a management meeting or an all-campus faculty flex day, she really works at getting rid of the myths that can run rampant through the rumor mill and actually hurt the reputation of your partnership. So I'm grateful for that lesson because I think that's probably the most effective thing we've been able to do to counter that dark side. We'll go to the next slide, please. So as you're thinking about strategic planning, I'd encourage you to think about those whom you collaborate with daily. Are there local visionaries that you could see having a keen interest in developing concurrent enrollment? And or if you have concurrent enrollment partnerships already, what is your next step? Are you looking to expand it? Are you looking to go for accreditation? Are you just looking to improve the viability or the perception of your program so that it is better received within the community? So in articulating your goals, are you aligning with the K-12 district? Are you working with schools that are adopting the Common Core standards? Because that's, a hot topic right now. Are you aligning with your own post-secondary institution? So for our post-secondary statewide, we have new legislation around student success, and there are very clear mandated requirements within there for students to have an education plan. So that's now part of our Get Focused, Stay Focused goal that's under our concurrent enrollment. So also think about what professional development needs you have. I think sometimes the community messaging, that communication piece, can be done through professional development and getting the key players to the table and then having them disseminate the information out to their faculty departments, out to any parent groups, PTA, whatever you have in your area that will help to message more positively. And also think about the information and resources that you want to develop. And, of course, if there's anything I can do to help from our institution, I'm always happy to do that. My contact information, I believe, will be provided. And it's been a pleasure to be here. And thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, Lauren. And we're going to immediately turn the mic over to Loralee, and then we'll do a Q&A afterwards. So, Loralee, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I have to say that I was pretty surprised at the turnout at this session. It really struck a chord at the NACEP conference. It was standing room only, and that was pretty exciting to see and realize that I'm not the only person who deals with this. We can move to the next slide. I'll tell you a little bit, just a snippet about our program at JCCC. We are preparing to celebrate our 30-year anniversary. We have a relatively small geographic area. We've been through the NACEP accreditation process twice, most recently this past year. We received the good news. We've accomplished that again. We have about 300 instructors, 25 high schools, 3,300 students. So we can move on to what we'll talk a little bit about today, and then we'll see what questions everybody has. You can go to the next slide there. The different forms our critics can take, the common critiques and approaches for managing these folks, and, of course, how NACEP can be of great assistance when it comes to our campus critics of concurrent enrollment. So, our internal critics can, of course, be individuals. Sometimes I've been surprised to find out that people who are critical of the program are completely unaffiliated with the program. Sometimes, unfortunately, about a decade ago when I started working specifically with the program, they have been closely affiliated. They're new to working with concurrent enrollment. They just don't know yet. Hopefully, this is not the case, but it could be your boss who doesn't like the program. Could be somebody influential, or the most common, if we had everybody's voices tuned up right now, faculty have been a common critic of this program, of these types of programs. At one point, at least in my institution, we had a whole department try to secede from our concurrent enrollment program, and other people had voiced opinions at the live session. Okay, we can go on. So some of the common critiques are they don't know what's going on, what's happening in the high schools, how could they possibly be doing as good of a job as we do on campus. People assume that there's a lack of oversight, rigor, that we have a lack of control for what goes on in the classroom, and gets back to a little bit of what Lauren said. Sometimes there's an elevated expectation, elevated over what we even expect of our on-campus classes. And sometimes talk of expanding into a new department that hasn't worked with the type of program before, a sense of panic flows over them. The world, as we know it, will end if we release any of our curriculum out to anybody who is not us. So this is kind of the flow chart. If I was better at making flow charts, this would look like a flow chart. The questions I've learned to ask myself. At first, I was really eager to just have everybody love concurrent enrollment, understand concurrent enrollment, but now I ask, is this person involved with the program, and do they need to be? Are they an influential person? And so I decide, do I care if they like the program or not? And then if their opinion matters, I have to dig in and decide what are their specific concerns with our concurrent enrollment program. And then, as Lauren said, supply them the specific information, get them the information about the transferability, the rigor, the oversight, the site visits, the syllabus review, the professional development. Let them know exactly what is going on with the oversight for the program. Pull them close to the program, put them on an advisory committee, maybe a very small one, and ask them to contribute to the program. Bring them in for professional development events, feature some of their interests, and have them collaborate with folks surrounding their same topic. Okay, and also then we, of course, in the live one, we had a dialogue, and we can do some of this in the Q&A. And sometimes these strategies have worked. Sometimes some of our biggest critics have turned into some of our biggest fans. These strategies have been successful for us, and sometimes we've just had to give up. When I first started working with the program, I was told by my boss, oh, yeah, this person in this discipline, you can meet with him, but he really doesn't like the program. And there was no changing his mind, and so I went to that dean and said, we need a different liaison. This person doesn't like the program. They really shouldn't be working with our high school partners. And we got somebody else who's been really effective. So a whole department, a determined group, an organized group on campus could be pretty insurmountable. So ask yourself the same questions. Is this group influential on campus? Is it a lone department? Or, oh, gosh, I hope not, but could be faculty senate. And are they directly involved with the program? And then decide if you care if that group doesn't like the program, if they're a critic of the program. I'm sure you've experienced this if you're dealing with critics about of your program. A lot of their critiques are these two things on the slide, anecdotal and dated examples. I've had professors who've told me that they have worked here for many, many years, and then they've told me that they don't like our concurrent enrollment partnership program, and then they've told me why, and then it is an anecdote, usually a very dated one. And then I ask if they've heard of the National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Partnerships, and then we go from there. Okay, go to the next slide. So working with a whole group of critics, there are, of course, a couple of options. Some of these sound, gosh, on the end of a long day, kind of overwhelming, but maybe you could meet with, oh, I got kicked out. Hold on just a second. You can meet with them as a big group. That sounds maybe not the best idea. You can meet with a group of their leaders, try to determine their questions. You can definitely share a lot of your data with them. Suggest collaboration on a project. Our campus is working with outcomes assessments, and some of our departments have already included our concurrent enrollment partnership program with their outcomes assessment project, and really found out that not only do our K through 12 partners know a lot more about outcomes assessments than we do, but they have found that when we need to move the bar on student success, our K through 12 partners are really leading the way, and those people have become converts. They love working on these outcomes assessment projects with our K through 12 partners. We've turned whole departments from being maybe neutral, not critics, but neutral about concurrent enrollment to big fans by engaging in a very intentional way with outcomes assessment. So these are some ways that have worked for us. So when I have come up against some strong critics over this last 10 years of working with the programs, and that people have shared dated or anecdotal gripes about, oh, well, once my neighbor's kid took a class and it was terrible, you know, I try to bring up in a nice way the fact that about any department, maybe even theirs, or about any institution, maybe even theirs, that there could be a dated anecdotal gripe about somebody that they work with in their collegial ranks. And then I also point out and explain to them we have great accountability for our concurrent enrollment instructors between the site visits that we regulate highly, the required professional development, the everything that we do through NASEP. And I venture to guess that, well, I know I'm an adjunct, we ensure way more oversight for our CEP folks than some teaching categories of some folks on some campuses, and I won't go into detail about that, but we can all intuit that, yes, we have a lot of oversight for these folks. And a lot of times the critics just don't know and just don't understand that. And also just to understand that not everybody's going to appreciate or like what we do, even when we explain it all to them and even when we provide the best amount of data. And people in the audience had great ways to respond to the critics. The Mythbusters idea, pulling together students, pulling together faculty, surveying them, asking about what they think about the program, what myths they've heard, and confirm some of the myths. Like, yeah, these classes are really rigorous. Or bust some of the myths, like, oh, of course these classes transfer. That's a myth that they wouldn't, those types of things. Those were fantastic ideas shared by a lot of people in the group. So, NACEP, I'm so grateful for the organization because of opportunities to share resources, share ideas for problem solving, share ideas at the conference and also in avenues like this. We've had so many issues that we've taken to the conference and left with solutions, more than one solution, that are affordable, workable. So getting together on a topic like this is very rewarding because it seemed like it really struck a nerve with a lot of folks that we all have critics on our campus. Hopefully they're not influential. Hopefully they're not insurmountable. But looking to the national set of standards and saying, first of all, there is a national set of standards, and our school follows them. And even if you're not accredited, say, this is what we aspire to do. This is what we follow. This is what we're leaning towards as an institution with our program. This is where we can take this program, or this is what we are doing. People don't understand that a program like this could be accredited, and bring them to the conference. Have them look at the website. Email them a link to the standards. They really have no idea until we tell them. So it's up to us to do a better job of explaining what we do in our programs to the people who are neutral, uninformed, or worst-case scenario critics. Just for our particular program, it's been around a while, but that doesn't mean we didn't have a lot of ways to improve. And so this is just the checklist I share with anybody who asks, what does NACEP do? Should we get accredited? Should I even attend this conference? Just the internal and external input and review, the tracking, additional tracking, the additional studies, the assistance with transferability of credits, the muscle it's given us when dealing with policy changes with our K-12 districts, and, of course, the collegial interaction and support. That's all due to NACEP. It's been very, very helpful when dealing with our critics, let alone the access to all the research. And that's really it.
Thank you so much, Loralee. Thanks to both for taking the time to make presentations. I'm sorry about the technical difficulties with you guys dropping off. We now have a good amount of time for any questions that anybody might have. Feel free to type it into this little question box here, and we'll see who's the lucky winner, Lauren or Loralee, to answer the first question. I also have to apologize for the entry and exit tones, folks. I thought this was our line that didn't have them. So next time, we will get that squared away. No questions.
Maybe some of our critics have called in, and now they're deciding to hang up. It's okay. You don't have to out yourself as a critic on this call. It's totally fine.
We have all NACEP members on the line, so hopefully we don't have too many critics.
Well, I know. There may be a spy or something.
I know, right? Well, if anybody can think of any questions for our presenters, then please feel free to email me or contact anybody here at NACEP to follow up. Like I said, we will be posting the audio of the webinar tomorrow, and we'll have their presentations available online for any members. So I do encourage you to pass it along to your colleagues.
Tim had a question.
Oh, here we go.
Tim wrote about, do we ever have our critics meet the high school teachers? Yes, we had a history critic become our liaison for a year. And he, even though we work at a community college, he is the epitome of kind of the four-year model, very much leaning towards just kind of a typical humanities professor, very bright guy, has written books, and just really didn't think all that much of the program until he worked with it for a year. And I've saved all the emails after his site visits. He said, oh, my gosh, I was so impressed. Wow, what a great job. And it really blew him away. And ever since that time, he's not been a critic. I won't say he's the biggest advocate But he's not a critic any longer, and so having him have that experience for a year was really, really good, really positive. So, yes, I think that that's a great thing to do. In fact, the department that tried to secede from our program back in 92, we had the textbook author here a few months ago, and gosh, maybe a year ago now, and we had more concurrent enrollment folks there to meet the textbook author than we did on-campus folks, and we still couldn't sway them. And so sometimes that exposure will sway them, and sometimes they're not having it. Nothing will change their mind. So that's my 2 cents.
So it looks like we also have a question here. We recently had our cabinet question if obtaining NASEP accreditation will decrease our overall dual credit enrollment. Will we lose high school partners that don't want to meet the standards? Advice to counter that. Lauren, Laura Lee?
I'm muted. I can't get in.
No, we can hear you.
Oh, you can. Yep. Sorry. On my end, it's not unmuted. I'm like, what's going on? I'm sorry. Was the question about accreditation? I can't see the screen either. I think I'm having technical shortcomings today. Sorry.
No, that's okay. The question was, they've had some individuals question if obtaining accreditation would decrease their overall enrollment because of high school partners that would not want to meet the standards.
Well, and I have to be honest, we had looked into doing accreditation last year, and while we felt that we met essentially all of the standards for accreditation, the one thing that we did not feel we could do at this time was the survey component. And part of that is because of our Get Focused, Stay Focused program. We're doing a longitudinal external evaluation with UC Santa Barbara, and we're doing 7,000 surveys a year, but we couldn't change that evaluation model that we'd already put in place and invested, you know, money into doing that research to switch over to doing another survey. And at this point, our state unfortunately doesn't have a mechanism for us to track students the number of years out that is required. So I can't really answer from an experience standpoint on that. Maybe Laura Lee knows more from her knowledge having gone through accreditation, but I would say, you know, we have brought all of those standards into our regular meetings and have stressed that that is what we are working toward, just like Laura Lee suggested, and we have not had anybody drop off because of that. However, you know, I think it's a legitimate concern if you do have folks who already feel that that the process is cumbersome. I know we have some faculty department chairs who find it inconvenient to have to go off-site to evaluate our adjunct faculty. So, you know, with the increased professional development emphasis through accreditation, that could be time-consuming for some folks.
We started around the same time really ratcheting things down in terms of these are the policies, we're going to follow them 100%. We implemented a small stipend to the teachers, which helped balance out that NASEP accreditation. So instantly we started getting almost 100% compliance on everything, which helped. It was kind of like the scene, where's my $2? Where's my $250? So we said, you have to do the syllabus. It has to be acceptable. If you don't attend a thing, So if I would say if your board's concerned about making people angry because they'll be asked to do possibly more than they're doing, if it's feasible, and depending on how your funding works, if you can implement a small stipend for the teachers, it could balance that out. We didn't lose anything, and I feel like our program got way better, higher quality, and it's continued to grow. We grew 9% just from last year to this year. And we still focus exclusively on quality, but it's that impresses the parents and it shows.
Great, thank you. That's very helpful, Laura Lee. I don't see any more questions coming in. Like I said, if anybody thinks of something after the fact and you'd like to follow up with me, please feel free to email or call at any time. You know, we're here for you guys, and we will be posting this online, so share with your clients and friends who weren't able to make it. And, you know, thank you once again, Lauren and Laura Lee, for being able to join us and present and share your infinite wisdom with all of us. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. It's been fun, and anytime anybody has any questions or just wants to visit Kansas, because it's a hot spot, I know, feel free to come visit our program, share stories about critics. We can introduce some of our critics to each other, and maybe they'll move away from our school to yours. So best of luck, everybody. Have a great break.
And ditto from me in Santa Barbara. We have a conference every January that we host here on our community college campus, and you know, Santa Barbara's not a bad place to be in January, depending on what part of the country you're coming from. So we're full for this year, but maybe next year if you're interested, we'd love to have you come and visit and learn more about our program model and, of course, exchange ideas with you and get all of your best practices. So if not there, then maybe I'll see you at next year's NACEP conference.
Thanks, Lauren. Yeah, and that's a good reminder that next year's conference is October 26th to 28th in Chicago, and more information will be coming out about that soon. So with that, I'll end this webinar and just say happy holidays.
Thanks, Kim.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Kim. Bye-bye.